Hello and welcome to the NHRA Insider Podcast powered by Speedmaster.
At the eighth mile, she's leading Bo Buckner at the finish line stripe. It's Cameron Caruso for the first time. 6.592.
On this episode, we're talking all things four wide Charlotte with Phil Burgess of National Dragster and Tony Pedregon.
And there goes Gage Herrera.
Four wide for the second and final time in 2024.
Chad Green's out first by a bunch. They get to the finish line stripe, and it's Chad Green! 391.6 on a hole shot, a 33 line.
This is the NHRA Insider.
End of the night they go, and the wind light comes off for Doug Collada! 367.3, 334 miles an hour.
Hey everybody, welcome to the NHRA Insider Podcast powered by Speedmaster. I'm your host Brian Loans, and today we are talking all things four wide Charlotte. Got Phil Burgess from National Dragster coming on, of course the man who has helmed that magazine for 40 some years now. The guy is on the ball with all topics four wide and certainly all topics NHRA. And Tony Pedregon going to be coming on as well as we set up this weekend's second and final four wide race of the 2024 season. Some news coming in. Dave Connolly will be driving a Pro Stock car. The entry list had him in as a Gray Motorsports entry, which had everybody scratching their heads. But my understanding is it will be a KB race car. And obviously, after Cameron Caruso's crash, they kind of went down a car, and I believe that thing is going to be fixed. I'm not sure what the current state of it is, but certainly the time window to repair that car seems too shrunken to actually be the car that he'll be driving. Some questions I have in my mind, you know, the rough start that Matt Hartford has had to this season. I believe it was at the Bradenton preseason race down there, the shootout, that Hartford had Dave Connolly in a Pro Stock car. So I don't know if maybe Hartford is going to be driving his old car, maybe Connolly shaking the new car down that they seem to be struggling with. We're going to be finding all that stuff out. Maybe one of our two guests will be able to lend some insight there. I think over the course of this conversation, we're going to figure out a few things. You know, last week's conversation with Jasmine Salinas was great. We found out that they tested after Vegas. And I'm going to talk to these guys about the fact that, you know, she's coming in with the same race car that broke the 300-mile-per-hour barrier in the eighth mile. From our conversation with Jasmine last week, it did seem to indicate that she has enough test runs under her belt now and enough competition runs that they are going to turn the wick up on that thing. We have two Friday sessions, a 5 and a 7:45 session. So Friday night is going to be fast. Saturday is going to be fast, and Sunday, if the forecast holds as it is, cloudy, kind of mid-high 70s, this should shape up to be a very quick weekend on a very good surface at Z-Max Dragway in Concord, North Carolina. As always, when we go down to North Carolina outside of Charlotte, we always have a great kind of NASCAR crossover. Those guys are racing in Dover, Delaware this week, so I'm guessing we'll see some of the stars of the NASCAR series, the Cup Series, probably on Friday. The Xfinity race is on Saturday, and of course the qualifying and for the Cup race will be Saturday, and the big race will be Sunday. So they will be occupied those 2 days, but I think we may see some folks hanging with us. And I do not believe the Truck Series is racing this weekend, so maybe we'll see the likes of the Gray Boys, Tanner and Taylor may come and hang out with us. Who knows? But whatever we do see, and whoever we see through the NASCAR lens will be welcome. It's always kind of fun when we go down there and cross over with our NASCAR pals. I know our NHRA on Fox team is shooting some NASCAR crossover stuff as well. So whole weekend is going to be pretty exciting. I know I am chomping at the bit to get back at it. The finish of the Vegas race, we talked about it last week with Bob Tasca and others, but it was really one for the books. When it comes to four-wide drag racing, it doesn't quite get any more intense than we saw. And we'll see if Doug Coletta can continue the Coletta Motorsports momentum. They are certainly the most dominant team in Top Fuel right now. We'll be talking to our guests about that subject as well. You know, I think as we look over the drag racing landscape over the course of last weekend, we saw the No Prep King series running at Maple Grove Raceway. Had a great crowd there. Sean Langdon was bracket racing last weekend, and he knocked off a 10 grander, I believe it was Friday or Saturday night, and then made the final for another big money race on Sunday. So I texted Sean after the fact when I saw his results from the event that he was racing at Bowling Green, Kentucky, and said, man, what you guys are, you're, himself personally, is just having the year of years right now. And he's very thankful for it. You know, he said, I couldn't buy a round win in anything for a couple of years, and now it doesn't seem like he can make a mistake. So the racing kind of circular nature of competition, especially in drag racing, is showing itself with great kind of grandiosity, if you will, through Sean Langdon. His success in the Top Fuel car this year, the multiple victories, and now picking up some dough in the bracket racing dragster that he has is pretty impressive stuff. And it's one of those things where, you know, he does one to help supplement the other in terms of keeping fresh and hitting the Christmas tree as many times as you possibly can. Having a great year, Justin Ashley, really, to me, the only other car that is rivaling Sean Langdon right now. And again, this is going to be a topic of discussion for our guests. As will Pro Stock Motorcycle. They are coming back this weekend. We've hinted at it. We've talked about it. The Pro Stock Motorcycle racers are all yelling at each other, and now they're yelling at Tony and I, and everybody's kind of fired up over there. And listen, I'm here for it. I'm here for all of it. I'm here for the tension. I'm here for the competition. I'm here to see what's going to happen when we get on the drag strip with the Pro Stock Motorcycles again, finally, after what I believe is about a six-week layoff. They ran Gainesville, and then we pick them up in Charlotte, and we see them with great frequency after this point in the season. So, a lot of great things going on. We talk about the kind of various things that are happening on the schedule. Nighttime qualifying in Charlotte. If you're a New England Dragway fan that will be heading to the New England Nationals, you will be seeing nighttime qualifying. If you're a Northwest Drag Racing fan or somebody who has been thinking about going to the Northwest Nationals at Pacific Raceways in Kent, Washington, there will be nighttime Friday night qualifying there for the first time in history. The track is bringing in extra lighting. It is always fast there. All those trees, I call them little oxygen factories. So it is always a very good spot to be making horsepower there. And on a Friday night, midsummer, it is going to be absolutely beautiful in the woods up there in Kent, Washington. So I'm digging it. Of course, you've all seen the release about the Virginia race that is going to be a two-day style event. It is a new venture, if you will, a new format for us to explore. Three qualifying runs on Saturday, eliminations on Sunday. There will be Lucas Oil Series drag racing, of course, on Friday, the qualifying and time runs being made in those classes. It's a new thing for us to try. Obviously, it was done at the Pro Shootout to start the season in Bradenton, or to kick the season off kind of officially in drag racing back in February. Worked great for them. Teams were certainly favorable to the idea when it was approached to try this in Virginia. And I'm glad the racetrack's on board with it, and I'm glad to see that we're doing some different stuff. It's always cool to experiment. I think it's going to be it's going to be interesting for all of us. Seeing three qualifying sessions in a day is going to be great. Turning those cars around, the intensity of that. So there's just a couple of notes coming up. And, of course, the 70th anniversary of the U.S. Nationals coming this Labor Day weekend. It is going to be massive. You're going to start to see a lot of stuff coming over the next few weeks. Some really interesting sponsor announcements coming. Some of the great stuff that the NHRA has planned to dedicate and commemorate this 70th anniversary. Also going to be big fun. But it's going to be a big, big weekend at the U.S. Nationals, and big week, really, as it always is. And we're going to ratchet it up another notch for the 70th. As I mentioned, this is the NHRA Insider powered by Speedmaster. You can check them out at speedmaster79.com online to check their entire product line. For what you're building, they likely have it. They have a huge array of parts and pieces that are available for all different makes. If you're working on something that isn't necessarily the traditional Chevrolet or Ford, they likely are making parts and pieces for your ride. You can check them out at speedmaster79.com. With that being said, when we come back, we'll have Phil Burgess of National Dragster. We'll have Tony Pedregon of the NHRA on Fox, and we will have a good conversation about the upcoming NHRA 4-Wide Nationals in Charlotte. Don't go anywhere. And we are back here at the NHRA Insider, powered by Speedmaster, joined by my two guests, got Phil Burgess of National Dragster, Tony Pedregon of the NHRA on Fox. Phil, how are you doing out there in California?
I'm doing great. I'm excited about Charlotte this weekend. Let's do it.
Tony, are you prepared for Charlotte?
I'm as prepared as one could be. How are you, Phil?
I'm doing great, yeah. Actually, looking forward to getting there, south of some nice weather that looks like this weekend.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I want to start this conversation. We're going to bounce a little bit around here, but you know, we got evening qualifying, 5 and 7:45 p.m. on Friday evening, which I think is great, and cloudy conditions, mild temperatures. It sets up to be pretty fast. The first thing I want to talk about here is somebody who could benefit really well from these conditions in their race car, and that is Jasmine Salinas. She is going to be driving the car that broke the 300-mile-an-hour barrier in the eighth mile at this racetrack. Phil, I had Jasmine on the show last week, and she talked about, you know, coming along and how Rob Flynn and Troy Fasching and the team are kind of getting her up to speed. But she did seem to indicate that they're going to kind of let her rip this weekend. And frankly, I haven't seen anything to indicate that she's not ready to handle that yet.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the car's been good. It's been in, you know, the 370s consistently. Haven't seen her make any mistakes. I mean, she's got a lot of A fuel experience, and I think she looks good.
You know, Tony, this process that she talked about coming along, I think Rob and Troy have handled it pretty well. Kind of what's your take so far on what we've seen out of Jasmine?
Well, I think the timing's right. You look at a couple of races and how much progress that she has made in that short amount of time, and you know, it's just a matter of getting her some time in the car, but more importantly, some time in competition. And, you know, of course, you got the car pretty sideways, but that's almost to be expected when, you know, when you're a younger driver, you're better off experiencing those things early on so you know how to adjust, you know how to deal with it, you know what to expect when the car loses traction when you're in the heat of battle. So she's gotten that out of the way, and that's really probably one of the most challenging things for a top fuel driver, funny car driver, is the car losing traction when you're caught up in a race. And, you know, at the four wide, she's not focusing on one driver. Not that she singled anyone out, but you're in the heat of battle. So the mindset, the approach is different. Your mind works differently when you're competing. And, you know, she didn't go over the center line. She didn't do anything crazy. It's something that very common that even the best drivers have done. You know, so she lived to fight another day. And I think moving forward, it just, the timing seems right for Rob Flynn to pull out some of the stops, like literally maybe some of the clutch stops right. that they run, you know, to manage the clutch. But I think the timing's good. I think she's ready, and I think that she's gonna break some hearts.
You know, Phil, one of the great stories, I think, coming out of Vegas, and we're not going to see him in Charlotte, but the Terry Totten story to me was fantastic. Oh, yeah. I mean, we've watched this guy come so far, and he's done it at his own pace. It was very gratifying, as, you know, the fan in me was cheering when Terry Totten made it to the second round.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's the second time he's done that at Vegas. I think he did it 2 or 3 years ago, the same thing. You know, just he's an A to B kind of guy, right? He's never going to run 370, but his car's going to go down the track most of the time. So see guys like that, you know, Rob Passy, you know, getting occasional win light here and there, it just makes your heart warm. It's like all the sacrifices they put in. They know they're never going to, you know, outrun Brittany head-to-head or anything like that, but they're out there every week putting on a show. They've got their loyal fans that follow them. And when they get a reward, we had a great photo, and it's in the magazine, it was on the website, of Totten's guy hugging him at the top end. And you could just see the pure joy in that moment for them. And that's, you know, that's why we do this, right? That's why they do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's nothing, you know, it's funny because on the face of it, you can say, oh, yeah, well, you know, Justin Ashley's guys ran down and hugged him, or this guy ran down and hugged him. But those moments when you see it in kind of that homespun way do really hit different. And it keeps this thing we have in this sport alive, in that a guy like Terry can, you know, can do everything in his humanly possible power to field this car with his volunteer crew and still have that taste of success.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Jim Dunn used to say, you know, everybody can only bring one of everything to the starting line. So, you know,
that's a great line.
Yeah. So you love to see that in our sport. You know, we talk about, oh, you know, Brittany maybe doesn't have this sponsorship level she had before, or whatever. But it's these guys, these, you know, these 10 to 12, 12 to 16 on the qualifying list, that really make our sport strong, that give us a full show every race. And that, you know, there's the fans that root for those kind of guys that are anti-heroes, right? They want to see the little guy do it because maybe they relate to them. And it's those guys that make our sport strong. So thank God we have people like Terry Totten or Rob Passy and all those people that come in and show up race to race and help us fill fields and give the guys a run for their money.
You know, Tony, one of the guys that can play that role this weekend who's on the entry sheet is Cody Crone. And Cody's going to be driving the Peyton family top fuel car, which we know is a proven mid-370s commodity. And we've also seen that guy can get off the starting line on time. So when I look at those kind of dark horse candidates that can ruin somebody's weekend in the first round, Crone's one of those guys I think we can put in that column.
I think a lot of these teams deserve credit. I think they've flown under the radar for the last few years. And if you look at the trend and the pattern, you know, at the Jeff Deals, And you know, the Mac attack, the funny car, it was, you know, it used to be guys like Pat Dakin, you know, were somewhat of a dark horse. Now there's eight of them, you know. There might be four or five of them in funny car. Look at what Densham's car did.
You know,
in qualifying, and even you know, getting beat Jeff Deal, you know, and we kind of didn't give him credit because there's so much going on the track. You know, all these hole shots and good runs and guys getting sideways, and you know, under the radar, he runs and makes his first 3-second run. We didn't even mention it just because it's a four wide. So I think, to your point, you know, Cody Chrome, it's a Todd Payton car, and it's, you know, it's always been competitive, and I think we see more and more of it. It used to be when we would see, you know, a team that really didn't have a chance unless somebody made a big mistake, and a lot of times a car could lose traction. If they were quick to recover, they'd still beat them.
Yeah.
You know, they still put a pull away, but that's really not the case anymore. And a lot of credit goes to those teams, to those individuals for getting better, but they haven't done it without the help of some of the bigger teams.
Absolutely.
You know, Don Schumacher, rest in peace. I think he was really one of the guys that wanted to see the sport continue to move forward. He wanted to see full fields, and he was one of many that really reached out and told his tuners, help those guys with what they need. If they need parts, help them parts. If he could sell more parts, you know, he was a businessman, but you know, he gave an awful lot to those teams. He wasn't alone. You know, Forces reached out and helped a lot of those guys, as had, you know, the Colettas. So credit to the bigger teams, but a credit to the smaller teams for kind of, you know, taking the initiative and opening themselves up to improving.
Phil, you know, speaking of the Coletta team, in your experience covering this sport, has there been a more stark turnaround of a single car than we have seen of Sean Langdon's this year? From futility to just, I mean, he's not dominant, but he is, in my opinion, him and Justin Ashley, the class of the field.
Yeah, absolutely. I went back and looked. He had 13 round wins all of last year. He's got 9 already this year. You know, that speaks testament right there to that. And, you know, credit Brian Houston for sure for that turnaround.
Yeah, and is there an equivalency, even if it's not a direct equivalency, can you think of somebody who has been able to kind of flip-flop this in this manner over the course of two seasons that you can kind of remember?
No, I can't remember that much of a turnaround to go from somebody who was, you know, I mean, all the teams struggled, right? All three Coletta cars were not that great early last year. Doug obviously got hot later. You know, JR obviously had his problems. But to me, the turnabout as a whole is what really impressed me. All three of those cars now are where we always thought they could be and where they should be. And, you know, obviously, you know, Doug doing good this year. JR's killing it too. So, but as an individual car that's made the, you know, an A to Z turnaround, nothing comes to mind like this.
Yeah, and Tony, what about for you, kind of like along the same lines? I mean, you know, the success of Doug Coletta's car obviously has allowed some of this stuff to happen with Houston being able to be the guy on Langdon's car. And it's just and listen, Langdon goes out last weekend and cracks him for $10,000 on a Friday night bracket race and then almost won the damn thing again on Sunday. So it's like he's feeling the flow right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's good that these drivers are staying active. You know, we see it in NASCAR. You see a driver like a high-level driver like Kyle Larson, you know, running a sprint car race and, you know, going to the 500 to practice and then running, you know, running a big oval, you know, the following day. So I think that it's important for drag racers, I think, even to keep themselves in the groove. You know, the talented drivers are able to make the adjustments from a pro tree to a sportsman tree. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that Sean Langdon has always been such a reliable driver. But, you know, I think for that team, you know, and I've been critical of the personnel, but it's not just the personnel. I think the fact that you know, Chad had initiated some changes for that team that were long overdue, because the expectations for Connie's car were, you know, were always for it to be a lot more competitive than it was. But I think the fact that they made some personnel changes, but also that Connie, I'm not saying that he stepped aside, because I'm sure that, you know, it's still his car.
Yes.
He's, you know, he still has the final say. But I think to some point you have to let your talent, you know, go in and make the changes. And I think he saw the success that Alan had and the short amount of time. I mean, it only took 2 years. The first year was kind of a feeling out a time for that team, you know, to make the adjustments to the car, to change the balance and the ballast, and, you know, to work around a new team and parts. And, you know, I think it's coming together. And I think for that, I think Doug's car, you know, we saw it. It's already winning.
Yeah.
I think they're going to hit their stride sooner than they did last year. And I think some of that's going to spill over to the funny car team. I mean, there's some talent there, and they've kind of been hit or miss. And if, you know, you've seen the pattern, just like all of us have, that car seems to be more consistent, more seems to be more competitive. And, you know, that's the DHL funny car that we expect to see on the track.
I agree. And, you know, we talk about changes in funny car. The most stark change, of course, was Austin Prock getting in the seat of the Cornwell Quality Tools Camaro. And he has just been, he's been unbelievable in that thing. And Phil, you know, when I put the script together for the open of this show, I talked about everybody's kind of up in their feels coming into this race. And man, Austin was pretty annoyed losing that final round to Bob Tasca in Vegas. And I'm not going to say I enjoyed him being annoyed, but I enjoyed the display of emotion there. You know what I mean? It was neat that this kid is not just looking around going, "Oh well, we'll get him next week." He was pissed.
Yeah, absolutely. That's just a competitive. We've seen that since he was running quarter midgets, right? Everything is his family. You know, his grandfather was a riding mechanic in the Indy 500. It's just, you know, born into the family and that competitiveness. And we always knew he was a good driver, right? We saw him in Top Fuel with a car that wasn't maybe always as good as he hoped it would be or they hoped it would be. But I think he was born to be a funny car driver. I mean, you know, he just fits right in there. And a lot of people would be happy with a runner up in their first race, and this. He's probably more mad they lost on a hole shot, as everybody else in that final round was, than anything. But, yeah, he's not going to quit until he's back way on top.
Tony, was there a little bit of young Tony Pedregon that came out of Proc there? Because listen, we all know you were a guy that did not enjoy coming out on the short end of one of these things, whether it was two wide or four wide. And I like that there was no loving handshakes, there was no loving hugs down there. He was curled up next to his truck, and look, he wanted to puke in his hands.
Look, that part of it is great, and I'm always going to push back on the staging procedure and the staging process. And you know, I said at the beginning of the year that this was going to happen, that Austin Prock is going to encounter something that he really didn't encounter in Top Fuel, even though they deep stage.
Yep.
They roll in. Don't let anyone fool you. Justin Ashley does, Josh Hart does, and they shine for it.
Yep.
And they're not criticized for it, but for some odd reason, for the life of me, I can't figure out why a driver would get out of his car and complain. It's like, you know, pitchers, and I don't really follow baseball, but from what I understand, they got a curveball, They got a fastball, right? Don't they have a knuckleball, a knuckle sandwich? And don't they have a spitball, for crying out loud? So why on earth? And these rules, Phil, correct me if I'm wrong, have these rules in this sport not been in place for the last 50 something odd years? Has the rollout changed? Was I out of that? Not in that meeting?
No. I think everything is apples to apples, you know.
Okay, so here you have, let me just explain something about deep staging, that drivers that choose to do it, which the biggest offender, the master of deep staging, signs his paycheck. So that I don't understand. I don't get it for the life of me. But let me tell you, let me give some drivers credit that choose to get creative, because Brian, did we not say at the top of the show that there are certain things that drivers can do?
Yeah.
And I specified drivers with experience that have the nerve to do it, they're going to come out on top. We said that on Sunday morning. So it takes nerves of steel, for starters. Not every driver has that. Not every driver has the fortitude nor the experience of trying it in qualifying or testing. Or in my case, I had the luxury of doing it when we were match racing. So you do a lot of match races, you get good. You can experiment with brake pressures. A lot of these things I never said because I didn't want my opponents, I didn't want my competition knowing what I was doing. But I knew that they're pulling on that brake and giving it the kung fu grip at 600 pounds. I knew that. I would casually ask their crew chief, "Well, what kind of brake pressure are we talking about? 300 pounds is better." But it requires nerves, some finesse, a good amount of experience, and the ability to improvise, because it doesn't always work out the way that you'd like. Sometimes if you want to roll in, you surprise yourself by knocking that top light out. You have to make that quick adjustment, but most of all, you have to still leave on time. it's not magic. So, you know, for a driver like Bob Tasca, and I'm pretty sure that every driver rolled in, but what are we going to do? Are we going to discredit them? I had this argument with someone years ago that they wanted to take that away. But I will tell you this, there's only a couple of dozen people in the pits that care about that. And they're brainwashed from the drivers that are told, you better shallow stage, don't be taking 200s away from me. So I say fooey on all of that, a win, and I think that will go down arguably, and without a shadow of a doubt, that will go down as the greatest round because of the circumstances. Yeah. It was a final round. They were funny cars, and funny cars are much harder to tune in the window of 200ths of a second than a pro stock car, even though we had seen it a couple of times at pro stock. But I think no one's going to argue that that will go down as the greatest to this point, the greatest funny car race that we've seen in four wide. And you can credit staging, whatever you want. All I know is I saw a guy walking out with the trophy, and it wasn't Austin Prott. And that's no knock.
No.
Okay. That's nothing. I love the raw, the authenticity,
yes,
and the competitiveness,
yes,
of Austin Prock. But I just can't for the life of me figure out, why do you want to confuse our viewers and talk about something that's not really relevant? If we were in a foot race and somebody said, hey, you got to race this cat, I'm going to give you a 7-inch head start. You know what 10 out of 10 people will say? I'll take that. I'll take that start. So. Right. So there you have it.
Well, listen, as Tony gets his heart rate back in check here, let's talk about John Force a little bit, because, you know, we know this the scope of this guy's life and career, the scope of his impact on the sport. Every one of his victories, especially at this point of his career, carries a lot of weight with it. And the fact that he was able to punch his ticket with that Winter Nationals win this year sets a different tone for the start of the season than we've seen out of him for a little while.
Yeah, I think that just, you know, when we were in Phoenix, he was talking about that morning before we ran the Pomona Finals, he was ready to quit. He said, I'm just going to go over to the casino and get drunk. You know, typical John Force. Toss off line, then he wins. And it's a brand new John Force. And we've seen this, you know, after the thing last, you know, with J.R. Todd, when he, you know, crossed the center line and got tied up, he felt like he wanted to quit then. And not that I'm his best friend or anything, but he called me and says, Burgess, should I quit? And I'm like, no, you just need to stop trying so damn hard to win that you're doing silly things.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if John Force never wins another race, he's still the GOAT, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So, is every single round live and die for him anymore like it used to be? No, it's not. You know? And you know, maybe he just gets, he wants to hit, he's got sponsors and crew and family and everybody that he wants to impress or feel he owes him something. But, you know, no matter what he does, he's still going to be the greatest funny car driver for sure, you know, and I'm a huge Dom Bourdon fan, but it, you know, that's just who he is. And so to see him be rejuvenated by that win, get that winner after one, I think that that's going to carry him through the year.
Yeah, and look, you know this better than anybody because you've known him longer. Well, actually, you too do because you both had a long-standing relationship with him and a much more personal level than I have ever had. But the guy's, and I say this with respect and love, the guy's neurotic nature is what made him as great as he is. And that neurotic nature, Phil, at times can start to work against you when it's not going your way. That insane amount of drive you have can start to become a detriment.
Right, and you know that the reason he deep stages, I think, is nothing more than the numbers. He wants to be able to claim that he can, you know, leave. So it's not necessarily, we know it's going to cost you lane choice, or maybe cost you lane choice. So I don't know. I wonder if there's time for a new way to measure that stat, because you don't know when you look at the numbers, the reaction time numbers. Did the guy deep stage? You don't know, right? Unless you watched it and took note. I think maybe Tony knows this, but I think at one time Frank Colley had something he called a DRT, driver reaction time, that actually measured the car moving versus when the tree flipped. It was more accurate measurement rather than, you know, breaking the beams.
Look, if they want to clean that up, if they put a laser beam on it, put a laser beam with no rollout and put a tab. But let me, I'll point something else out that's interesting that the drivers don't talk about. You know, they used to be body latches. You know what they call them now? They call them flags. You know why? Because that flag, it's the front tire that stages the car.
Yeah.
But guess what trips the timing light at the end of the track? You know, it's the flag, okay? So crew chiefs, I mean, they cheat all kinds of things. Now, whether it's 7 inches or whether it's a laser and you have this little, let's say you have a 2-inch rollout, you know what drivers are going to do? They're going to complain about this. Oh, he took an inch. So it's never going to end. And Phil, you know this. It's relative. I'll tell you why John Force deep stages, because it doesn't matter. What matters is winning, baby. And it's not just John hasn't been doing this, you know, for the last, 5 or 10 years. When I rolled out in a funny car at the U.S. Nationals for driving for Larry Minor, I didn't know anything about deep staging. I didn't understand much about the rollout and how much the car was rolling. All I know is I raced Force in the first round and I knocked the top light out, and he loved it. But this guy has been doing that since the beginning. And when his car started running good, when it started running better, it didn't matter to him. He just wanted to win races. So the race is to the finish line. And we're in the business of entertaining. And I just think, you know, another thing that I think is muddying up the quality of our TV show, because make no mistake about it, I always say this, we are in the business of entertaining fans, right? Viewers. We were up, 126%, Brian?
Yeah, huge, huge, wide. Huge jump on the four wide, yeah.
So a great audience, but the printer, I'd like to get a sledgehammer and go to the end of the track and smash that printer.
Yeah.
At the end of
yes.
Because right. To me, it is taking away from the natural reaction of a driver. There goes the element of surprise. And there's PR people, for starters, they're getting in the way of our pit reporters that are supposed to be looking at that monitor. But there's a small crowd of people that really have, they're just watching, they're fans at that point. But they want to get that printout, like a good little boy, they want to take that over to the driver. And it's taking away the driver. You know what they're doing instead of us seeing the thrill of victory or the agony of defeat? They're looking at some stupid piece of paper. That's what we're getting on our monitor. That's what we're showing our viewer at home. And I just think it's horrible. I don't remember Raymond Beadle. I don't remember Shirley Muldowney, Don Garlitz, Don Prudhomme looking at some stupid paper. I would much rather a driver get out and our reporter, our top-end reporter, go to them and Austin Prock say, well, I know what the driver in lane 3 is doing because I could hear him because he was right next to me. But I have no idea what those other guys are doing. And to be honest with you, I didn't know they were ahead of me. Whatever that natural interview would have been, but instead, the element of surprise is gone because we've got that stupid little printer. And if it were up to me, you know what I would do with it. But, there again, it's all about getting to the finish line. And I think when drivers bring up the fact that, look, they took a little bit of this, they took a little bit of that, to me, that is the equivalent of if we were road racing and a driver got a little too much apex, you know, like dip the wheel down in the grass, you know, they're not going to penalize them for that. It is what it is. And you see the NFL, they're going to cheat. An offensive or defensive lineman are going to cheat and use any trick or any tactic that is within the rules. And rolling the car in a few inches is well within the rules, and it's been that way for 50 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Listen, right. Go for it, Phil.
In your opinion, Tony, you know, if you took out deep staging, south fishing, who's the quickest lever?
The quickest guys are still going to be the quickest.
Yeah.
You know, hey, John may do it more because, you know, he's slowed down in his age, but, you know, he's still got it. Look, this guy's fifth in the points. He's got to win. Right? That's a lot more than most of those guys can say. So I'm just saying that he finds a way. So there's always, you cannot take away the mental aspect of this sport. We just saw it in boxing. It was one of the biggest fights of the year. And it's like this guy pulled off the biggest troll job for 2 months. He pulled it off. So it's like, guys, that's part of the game. That's part of the show. You take that away. And what do we have? Tennis? And I like tennis. And tennis players make a lot more money than most racers. But I just think it's an interesting aspect of our sport. It's part of the mental aspect of it. And I'll tell you, I've seen it for the last 25 years. Before I drove for John, during and after, I've seen how he intimidates a driver and how they beat themselves when they race that. Because you can stare a guy down. You can talk the talk. but that is one of the things that, that we have in our sport. It's one of the few things that we have in our sport, I think, is a good thing.
I agree. And listen, I want the top end printer to be parked Titanic adjacent, just like you do. I want it to be located the depths of the Marianas Trench. And I'll just put a point on that and say the reason I say it is because, you know, obviously the people that have had the most effect on me in my job, whether it's Mac or Evans or Brock Yates or any of these guys, the moments we all remember that are so iconic, especially let's go to the Kenny Bernstein run. You know, he walks up to Bernstein, yes. and he says, you know, you went 300 miles an hour, and Bernstein says 300, and then he says, no, 301, you know, and it's like, that's the stuff you remember, because right. Cause Kenny's like, you know, he's running his hands through his hair, he can't believe what just happened, because he hadn't seen it yet. And I think the same with, you know, Jim White, I think when he ran 291 in Texas, that was another thing, like, I know it was fast, but how fast did it go? When Etchells goes and makes the 4-second run, when Epler runs 300, these are all things that were delivered, and we got to see that moment of the person either being, you know, washed over with excitement or sometimes washed over with disappointment. So I agree with you 100% there, Tony. Let's move on to pro stock. Phil, I want to go to you first here. Kind of late breaking news that we got Dave Connolly in a pro stock car this weekend, which I'm not going to lie, gets me kind of excited.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Dave's, you know, what 25, 26 career wins?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, he's going to be driving Greg's new car. So that'll be interesting to see what might be new about that. But we know he's capable of handling that. He's won it. He's not won the four wide before, but he's been in the finals four wides before in Top Fuel and Pro Stock. So, yeah, I'm excited to see. It's kind of an interesting race for him to come back, it being the four wide. But I know Greg wants to get some laps on the car before he debuts it in Chicago.
And, look, we're starting to see in pro stock, of course, over the last, really the beginning of the season through now, we got 23 cars coming. So we are now back in this era where there are recognizable names that are failing to make these fields.
Yeah. Like Matt Hartford, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was the biggest one so far to me. That was the single biggest wow. And they have obviously had their struggles, which is a new car for them this year, and it has not been going their way. But, you know, Tony, no one's rooting against Matt Hartford here, of course, but on the other side of it, this has turned qualifying into a much higher value proposition than it has been in years, not just for pro stock, but across the board. Even in funny car, typically, we've been seeing 18, 19, of course, out west, 20 car fields, and it just changes the whole dynamic of the race.
That's the beauty of the sport being healthy, of the volume of cars that show up. And I'm not going to say it's automatic, but I mean, when you have 18, 19, let alone 20 to 23 cars showing up, you're going to get some drama, because now you've put pressure on all the other teams that they just can't, you know, we see 16 cars. Everybody knows they're going to make the show.
Yeah.
Get that wild card in there, 17 or 18. All of a sudden it's like, oh, we actually got to try to get down the track now. So I think it's great. And I think that Dallas and Greg have really battled back. I mean, what a great start for the elite team, for Erica, kind of, you know, starting the way she finished, really strong, winning races. But I think when she got beat in the Too Fast, Too Tasty, when she got beat during the race, I really think it shows everyone that, look, there is a way. There's a way to beat this. They're not invincible. They are good. They're not going to be easy to beat. They did fall off. They shook the tires, but they can be beat toe to toe. And I think that's good for the class. I think it's great for the sport. And I think even the quadras, you know, I think if they can minimize the red lights and their cars can get to be a little more consistent, which it seems like all the elite cars are just a little bit better. And now with Jeg in the mix, it's like, man, this pro stock is really getting interesting.
Yeah. I mean, go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, when you have Jerry Tucker qualifying number one, I think, you know, the line has always been, well, you know, Erica's always going to get the best motor in the elite camp. You know, that there's, you know, whatever. But, you know, when Jerry Tucker can go number one and you got Jeg winning the race, it brings a lot of interest to that class. And like you said, the quadras. You know, one of these days, one of those guys is going to win a race. I'm not sure which one, because they're all, you know, David's really impressed me this year. You know, and Fernando Jr. and Christian obviously have been good the last couple of years. But to see that, to see Jeg back in the class, you know, new people like Brandon Foster, Sienna, it's made it a real interesting thing. And you can no longer just stage up and know you're going to qualify for the show.
Is it fair to say, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I'm going to throw it out there to you first, Phil. Is it fair to say that Jay Coughlin, not just by name, but now by winning performance, has become the largest internal rival that Erica has inside Elite Motorsports? I mean, Aaron Stanfield's great. Other cars are great. But is this guy now established himself as threat number one inside the camp?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to say what John Force said when he hired Tony Pettergun. I hired my own assassin. So, Jag winning, not a big surprise. You know, maybe a surprise it took him six races to do it, right?
Yeah.
But we knew he was going to do it. We know that there's good horsepower there. We know that he's probably the best pure driver out there in pro stock. I think that he's going to give Erica a handful this year, and would not surprise me if you know that them and Dallas and Greg end up in the top four in the end.
Tony, would you put Greg, Dallas, or Jag as the biggest threat right now?
Well, that's a tough call right there, but based on the last race, why not Jag? You know, I mean, that team has been a little bit better, and I'm not saying that they've lacked talent. I mean, they still have had a lot of talent go through that team, but I think that Jag seems to have picked up, you know, right way. He just doesn't seem to have missed much of a beat. I don't think if there was any rust, he was able to work that out at the end of last year and has had a little bit of time to think about it and to improve. And, you know, it's like this guy, it's almost like he never left. So, you know, but it changes week to week. You know, when Greg, the first couple of races, even when he ran Erica close, it's like, this guy's going to be a factor. But, you know, it fell off. It's like, it's so hard. He might have plucked one too many nose hairs, but it just, you know, that's what he told us. Or maybe not enough, but, you know, it is hard. It's hard to do it week in and week out. The majority of what a driver has to do is it's just like Austin Proc. You're going to get got, right? Marshawn Lynch said that. You have to deal with it. You have to come out swinging at the next race. I think for Austin Proc as well as Greg Anderson, I think that has to be the modus operandi, is they cannot allow that to happen, you know, back-to-back races. And I think the pattern is simple to see. The good drivers are able to rebound.
Yeah, and of course we see these fields that are, you know, what, 500s or so top to bottom. There's no breathing room in there at all for mistakes, and, you know, that really is continuing to drive the competition forward in pro stock as it always does. We got to get to pro stock motorcycle because, you know, Phil, they say, like, if you leave animals unattended in a cage, they start to do things. They start to attack each other. They start to maybe throw certain stuff at each other. It has been a very contentious 6 weeks away from the racetrack for pro stock motorcycle. And thankfully for us, it all gets to come to a head start with qualifying on Friday.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. You know, we haven't seen them, you know, since Gainesville, right?
Yeah.
So it's been a day or two, and it's been a lot. You know, anybody that follows anybody, Matt Smith got a lot. You know, he's a competitive guy, and I understand that he's got beefs about this, and you know, he comes from a family that does not take rule changes and rule clarity very calmly. You know, and you know. It's, you know, the proof's gonna be in the pudding. You know, is this really Vance and Hines versus Suzuki versus V-Twin world, or is it, you know, is it because Gage is that good of a rider? Proof's gonna be in the pudding, right?
It is gonna be in the pudding. And Tony, you got to go inside the pudding factory this week. I don't know how much you want to reveal about that, how much you want to say for the show, but the one side of this kind of barrage of words that we really haven't heard much from is Vance and Hines, but you got to spend some time in the shop with those guys.
That sense of time, I see him all the time at lunch, and we talked about it even before the season started. But, you know, they got busy. You know, things really ramped up for us. But I don't want to reveal too much because, in fairness, you know, I do want to talk to Matt. I'm going to get to the race early. I'm going to spend some time with him. You know, I know you and I we teased it a little bit on the show, and I only had a little bit of time to comment. I think there's some things that Steve Johnson could improve, and I know I'm being a little bit critical, but in fairness, I want to have that conversation with Steve, but I will say this. I've been doing my homework, and I think about what I say before I say it. And Brian, like we are always able to, we can back it up, but there's no mistaking that you cannot deny the fact. And we can go back 3 years ago, and there was this gal named Karen Stoffer, a very experienced, very seasoned rider that was setting national records, setting track records. You and I saw it. The world saw, anyone that was at that race or watched that show saw her run a 6.66. Okay. That was a record back then. Vance and Hines was there. Eddie Krawick, Angel, they were on those bikes. Now, that performance, no one's gotten close to. Angie was closest to Vance and Hines. She ran a 6.69. She dipped into the 6.6 range. I said it then, and I'll say it again. What the question that the competition of Vance and Hines has to answer is, why have they fallen off so much? Okay, I know we brought that up. We showed some graphics on our shows last year. Yep. We saw it unfold before our eyes. And Vance and Hines was quicker, a little bit quicker, but everyone else slowed down a tenth of a second. And I'm not saying they're not putting their work in, but, you know, I think we're going to speak with Tim Kalungian. He seems to, you know, have be a little unbiased. And I think that some of the racers are going to, you know, voice their opinions. But it's going to play out on the track. There's no mistake in that. And I don't think there's any denying the fact that when Gage got on a bike, everything changed. Things picked up.
Yeah.
It was the same bike Angel was riding, right, for the most part. And maybe they were able to, you know, to pull out some of the stops and get it to accelerate harder. But I think the talent that he has on that machine complement what they are doing. And I'm not saying that these guys aren't as good, but you know, you've got to look at a few things. You've got to look at the performance, and a bike, unlike a top fuel car or pro stock car, you know, with at times in a funny car, it might be 50-50. You know, the driver doesn't make up the majority of the performance in a funny car.
Sure.
Or a top fuel car. On a bike, that's really not the case. What is the split? Maybe we need to ask them. Is it 70-30? It's more rider than it is on a four-wheel machine. So, you know, you can't take that away from them, but I just don't want to say a lot of what I talked about with Vance and Hines, just to be fair, you know, to the guys that are complaining. They might have been complaining anyway, right. But we're going to find out.
And, you know, Phil, I guess the one thing, what is the thing you key in on when we're watching Pro Stock Motorcycle this weekend? Is it about Gage's performance? Is it about Matt's performance? Is it about Steve's performance? When you look at what you're going to be kind of paying most attention to when things kick off Friday, what's going to kind of be the thing you key in on?
I want to see how Gadsden's bike compares with Gage, because technically the same bike, right? Same approximate weight on the rider, and you know, is this really a technique thing that Gage has mastered, which seems to be the narrative that's out there that other people are trying to imitate? Maybe not as successfully as he has. So that's what I'm going to see. And if Gage's bike is demonstratively quicker than Gads, then I'm going to go, okay, this is more rider. And that's a great question, Tony. I'd like to know what the split is on driver versus, you know, versus vehicle. Obviously, in the nitro cars, it's not as much unless the car gets out of shape or whatever. Post-stock car, obviously, you're trying to hit the shift, so there's a lot of driver involvement in there, but not a lot of body language or anything. So I'd be interested to hear what their ratios are on that. But to me, the measuring stick for me will be between the Vance and Hines bikes.
Because in reality, that's the only apples-to-apples comparison we can make, and a direct one-to-one. So that makes total sense to me as well. And, you know, Richard's done a nice job for himself early on in that thing, and we're going to continue to see him kind of evolve through the season. I guess the final question I'll hit both you guys with is, conditions-wise, we're looking at, again, even qualifying, we're looking at a nice, cool, kind of cloudy weekend. What should we see, Tony? Let's go to you first on this. Performance-wise, on a one-to-one comparison with Vegas, how much should we pick up here, do you think, on average? Should we see half the field in the high 360s of top fuel? Should we see less than that? What should we be looking at?
Well, we should. We should see the performance that we expect when we get a little bit of cloud cover. The racers, the tuners, they like four sessions. And from Phoenix to the Vegas 4 wide, we saw the level of competition ramp up. We saw the tuners start to make better adjustments from the first qualifying session to the second to the fourth. You know, the weather always plays a role in it, but mild conditions and four runs, and these tuners at this stage, they're starting to hit their stride. You know, we're not one or two races in. Yeah. You know, the drivers, the tuners, they have excuses. Look, they don't have a lot of runs. Even when they test it, the conditions change from week to week. But based on those conditions, they should be a lot like they were in Vegas, without the high elevation, with better air, Is the track going to be as smooth? Maybe not, but there's so many adjustments with these cars, the clutch management system, the clutch itself, the weight, the lockup levers. There's so many adjustments that they can master this racetrack. So I think we should see the quality of competition ramp up, as well as we should see better performance, not from one or two cars, but from several cars.
Phil, take us home.
Yeah, right. I agree with that. I think, you know, you look at Vegas, and we know that it's altitude. We know the air is dry. I'm looking at the funny car field. There's 16 people there. Someday we're going to have an all 3 second field. This might not be it. You know, I think Jim Campbell's like a 4-0 car, John Smith's a 4-0 car. But, you know, these are the kind of places that can happen. The other thing I'm looking forward to is we're going to have a Factory X here.
Yes.
And I think we're going to see some more cars in the sixes than at 200 at this race. So, with those, you know, obviously we didn't get that at Vegas. I think Lowy T was a 12, Greg Stanfield. So I'm looking for that. That's exciting. I'm excited about that class. I know a lot of other people are too.
Yeah, and the amount of runs, you know, them, they're still, I think, obviously they've tested these cars and run them, but still navigating the 10.5-inch wide tires part of it. And again, the more fruitful air for horsepower as well. So yeah, that'd be great to see more members of the 6-second 200-mile-an-hour clubs respectively in Factory X. Phil Burgess, as always, man, thanks for your perspective.
You betcha, man. It's been great to be on. Look forward to seeing you guys in Charlotte.
Yeah, man. Tony, travel safe. I will see you down at the racetrack, and you know, shoot a flare up if you're in the Pro Stock motorcycle pits and it goes wrong. Send the bat signal up. I'll be right over.
Just take your steps, Tony.
I will say to you two, keep an eye on that flare, because some of the stuff that I've said on this one. Hey, I'm looking forward. Friday's going to be good. Hey, we're going to have a hella podcast on Saturday, so yes. Stay tuned in for that too.
Yeah, the NHRA Insider Live will be coming to you at 9:30 a.m. Eastern. On a Saturday morning, YouTube will be live there. We'll be live across NHRA's fast and streaming channels. Thank you to you two. I'll be back with some final thoughts in this episode of the NHRA Insider, powered by Speedmaster, right after this. All right, everybody, back here with some final thoughts in this episode of the NHRA Insider, powered by Speedmaster. We come into the Charlotte 4-Wide Nationals fired up. Tony Pedregon is on the chip today. That was some good stuff. Yeah, sure, we'll be hearing about that in the pits over the course of the weekend. But hey, listen, that's what makes this stuff fun. You got to have passion. You got to have some fire behind it. I think it's one of the things I appreciate most about working with the guy. The two of us, I got his back till the end. He's got mine till the end. And we certainly end up finding ourselves in some interesting conversations, of course, for race weekends. But hey, that's what we do this for, right? If you're just going to sit around and hold hands and not have an opinion, why bother doing the show? That's what makes it fun. Phil Burgess, ever the professional, bringing the heat, bringing the great insights, and certainly bringing his experience of decades in this sport. And he has a viewpoint that I think is just so fun to listen to and kind of absorb, because this guy knows it all. Just when I think I know half a thing about drag racing, Phil Burgess once and always shows me that I got a long, long way to go. As always, thank you for watching. Tune in 9:30 a.m. Eastern for live from Charlotte. NHRA's YouTube, of course, you're going to be on we're going to be on Tubi, we're going to be on Roku, we're going to be on our Sling channel, we're going to be on Plex, we're going to be on the Samsung app. Anywhere you watch NHRA live outside of our great partnership with Fox, you're going to be able to find us in the Insider Live, 9:30 a.m. Eastern from Charlotte, North Carolina at these 4-Wide Nationals. Thanks as always for watching. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. More hot takes, more opinions, and hopefully no top-end time slip printer, right? That was a big one. As always, see you next week.